Okay, I'm back. Sorry, guys. I'm back.
Okay.
Sorry, I blinked out, and I thought you had blanked out there for a second, Damon, but I guess it was a problem of mine. Okay. Sorry about that, everyone. Thank you, Niels, for jumping in and filling up the space there and helping us out. Okay. Shall we get back to where we were?
Sure.
Okay. Which was, you were mentioning growth, and you guys have sort of like stabilized a little bit now. And I think you were going to sort of tell us how you're doing the best you can to get cards in and cards out. And I guess, you know, what kind of things have you guys done to streamline that process, or new things that you're implementing or you want to try to kind of make operations more efficient?
Yeah. Really, like the big things I'm focusing on currently is how we buy cards and how we can make that easier for people trying to sell us cards. So exploring a bunch of different things, not quite ready to talk too much about it because I'm not sure exactly how it's going to implement itself, but hoping at some point in time early next year we are able to make it much more like you put cards in a box and send it to us, instead of, you know, all the extra work into putting all the orders together and making sure everything's sorted. So not sure exactly how that'll spell out, but that's a big focus of mine, is how to improve that experience for the people selling. Because as you and your listeners know, putting, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 cards into an order takes a long time, and getting them sorted so that they're in the right order takes a long time. And see if we can make that better. So that's a big thing I want to accomplish in the next year. Cool. On top of that, you know, when we're super busy, we're just buying and selling cards and trying to keep up. And then when we have these lulls where, you know, business is good and things are going well, we get a little more time to start working on new products. We have been, you know, investing in our teams, investing in how we look at our data, investing in how we look at pricing, investing in how we look at just the use of our site and developing our infrastructure and making it more scalable. And we've been doing all of that a lot over the last year, and that's been our primary focus. And I feel like a year ago I was telling you the same thing, but we're, you know, still slogging through it and getting everything on a new platform and making it the best that we can so that we can start developing more quickly. So I still feel this year coming up, 2020, we should have a lot of new features coming out, and I think it'll be good for everybody. I would just like to make it easier for people to buy and sell cards. That's what my, you know, we have a lot of work going on marketing and, you know, with our stores and new services. But, you know, from my perspective, the thing that I'm personally chasing after is how to make it easier to turn cards into dollars, or dollars into cards, or cards into other cards, and trying to remove the barriers that get in the way or take a lot of time.
So I want to get your perspective on something, and this is related because this is sort of a perspective I've had and I've chatted with people about. But it seems like in all of this, and in making the market more efficient as it grows, and with buying and selling becoming more sophisticated, I feel like the one area that seems to be lacking significantly is data, big data, data science, data services. I mean, we're talking about, you know, thousands and thousands of cards, each with a different price, and they move at different rates at different times of the year, and their values go up and down. I mean, it's so sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
Do you, and I don't, obviously you can or cannot go into whatever you guys might be doing, but how, you know, are you guys looking into like how data, you know, how you can improve and make the data side of things more efficient? Or do you have processes that you're sort of advancing or implementing that, you know, can take advantage of or create sort of allow you to see the bigger picture data?
Yeah, we've talked a bit about that. And the biggest problem that we've had is we have all of that data captured, but it's not in the best format, or it's hard for us to query or display. And we have been working on our logging system for when something happens, you know, when somebody buys something, when they sell it, what the price is at that time. And we've never directly put that into a database in a easily digestible way. But we do plan to do that. That's one of the things on our roadmap, is to start capturing that data in a better way, so we could actually give you better history of card sales, card prices, and all of that. you know, frankly, that's one of the things TCG players always done so well is, you know, seeing that card history of price is a, you know, nobody else has really done that. And everybody just kind of uses their graphs. So yeah, there is some interest in trying to get that information in front of others.
And along with that, you know, just technology advancements in the industry, do you all have, you know, are you guys doing any interesting things with technology to sort of, you know, make the operations in the industry more efficient? Because, you know, again, we're talking about labor intensive packing and shipping out thousands of cards and these small objects and, you know, sorting and all that. Are you all doing anything kind of interesting with technology?
Not a ton with technology. We do a lot with process. We are, you know, constantly looking at new ways to pack orders or to make our tags that identify cards, you know, different to make it easier on the eyes and easier on the order packer. Different ways of approaching, like, is it better for multiple people to pack an order or one person to pack an order all the way through? When shipping orders, just laying out the screen so it's easier that you're, you know, getting your address and your shipping information so it's a more fluid process. You're not jumping around and entering data in random boxes. And so we've done a lot of that over the last year, year and a half. And, you know, we continue to try to make that better all the way from, you know, not only is it better for efficiency, but it's actually better for the people doing the work to, you know, have something that's clear and easy and just makes their process better. So we put both of those together and try to continually improve everything we do. And we've been shipping cards for, you know, 20 years now. So it's one of those things where we feel like we're good at it, but then as soon as you bring somebody new in who's never seen it before or somebody who has a background doing that type of work, there's always more you can do.
Well, I know, you know, I've had the pleasure and the honor of visiting you guys a couple times, and I had a chance to see, I mean, you probably have the most sophisticated fulfillment process that I've ever seen in the industry. I mean, you're like a mini Amazon for Magic. So is there any, can you kind of give us a, because I know a lot of people are probably curious, can you kind of provide sort of a sneak peek or an idea of what your fulfillment process is like? Because for a lot of people, they just think, my gosh, Card Kingdom does all that. Like, how do they manage all of this? And how does this even run or work? Maybe you could let, you know, kind of give people an idea of what that system is like for you all.
Yeah, it's just kind of step through it. And this has changed over time. It used to be like cards that came in, you know, somebody would open mail, process the cards through grading, you know, verify they're authentic, look at the grade, separate them, enter all the data, and then put the cards away and then grab another order. And we've evolved over time with that just because of, you know, as we start receiving more and people are used to faster service, like we actually log everything in as soon as we get the mail in, right? We get the package, we say how many cards it is, we get them put into a queue. And then that way the customer says, hey, Card Kingdom has received my order. So you don't have that, you know, usually we try to get to it the same day or within a day or two. But every once in a while, we would have these spikes where we were buying a bunch and we would get behind. And if it took a week, you know, people are feeling frantic that, hey, I shipped my cards, you should have them. Where are they? So first step is we take the cards, we log them as received, get them set up in a way that's very easy to process for the grader, so they're not dealing with piles of, you know, packaging material and they have all the cards together and they're not worried about them being in the right order and all of that. So they get staged, then they'll get passed on to a person on the grading team who, I think I've talked to this about you before. We start by grading from the back of the card, separate into piles, verify the fronts of the cards. We think that gives us a more consistent grading because the back of the card is the same on every card, you know, pretty much. And then, you know, make sure that everything's good on the front, that there aren't any differences in that. Then we enter that data and into that to get the order finalized and then submit that. Then we actually put them into bins and separate them by edition. So at that point, we're putting all the different editions into different boxes. That way the people putting them away aren't walking from, you know, in the old days, walking from third to Zendikar was, you know, a bit of a hike, but not really that much. And as the number of sets have come out, our inventory has grown, that's become farther and farther. So by just getting that together, putting cards away is more efficient. So you get the cards put into inventory, submit everything so everybody's getting paid, and submit everything to our inventory so our inventory updates. And then the opposite side of that is the fulfillment. and we will print basically queues of orders at one time. So we will, you know, have them all put together, print all the invoices out, and then teams will separate those based on the type of things that are being packed and where the order's starting, and they will pack the orders and ship the orders. That is one that we've, you know, we constantly are reevaluating. Is it better to have the product in line with the cards? Is it better to have the product separate from the cards? Is it better to, you know, separate invoices or just grab the top invoice? And so that's something we play around with and we change over time. But then we have everything set up on schedules to try to make sure that as many packages as we can get done and packaged and in the hamper and are loaded onto the truck so that that goes out with that day's mail. That's just a big thing with us, is trying to get cards out as quickly as possible. And if we can really focus on getting things done by the time the truck leaves, that saves anybody who has their order packed after that an entire day. That's the basic process. I don't know if it's surprising in any way, but that's what we do.
What about what about for buy list or for like cracking boxes and whatnot and dealing with that side of singles?
I mean, that's, we do a bit of that ongoing, but most of that happens like right at the release. So that's just a whole different animal where we take a bunch of people from a bunch of different teams. And as soon as cards arrive, it's just all hands, you know, cracking and sorting as quickly as humanly possible, getting them all laid out. And then basically, as soon as we have enough that we can start packing orders, we will start printing all of the pre-sale orders and then collating those in separate areas until they're ready to go out on the truck Friday morning. Then we have an extra truck come in and put all of those onto the truck. So it's kind of the same thing, but in a very mini, extreme version of packing the regular orders, just because everything is very short on time. We try to get everything out for the pre-sale on that Friday of the release. And so it's a constantly increasing, it becomes more and more difficult over time, and then we just throw more and more at it, but we still try to do that.
Cool. Okay, well, we ended up getting a ton of questions from folks, so I want to make sure we have enough time to at least address as many of these as we can, where appropriate. So you want we can kind of like dive into some of these?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, so first question was regarding your operations, and you guys, you mentioned about, you know, you're pretty large and you continue to kind of consistently grow, and you've reached a stable point, but you're still year over year growth. So that's cool. So I think you mentioned briefly, and the next question was, why do you not do any tournament series? And I guess you had said that's kind of, you're leaving that wheelhouse to CFB and SCG, and you all are focusing on the in-store experience.
Yeah, we're really, I mean, and that's, and feel free to, you know, send me feedback, or, you know, shout out to Tarkan right now, but I've really enjoyed the stores and opening the stores and having a place where people can play every week. And that's my goal. And that's where I put my energy. So really the main reason we don't do the big tournament scene is because we're putting our energy into retail stores and trying to make those the absolute best experience that we can for our customers.
Okay. Next question here. Do you have any plans to expand your operations to different parts of the US anytime in the near future? And you mentioned Portland, which is opening soon. You kind of also said that, you know, you hope to have a lot more stores. Do you have any, can you provide any insight as to after Portland, what the, you know, what you're looking at or what might be down the road?
Yeah. I mean, we're looking around where we've been scouting locations for a little while. And honestly, we're putting our attention on Portland currently. And as soon as that's done, I think we're going to try to do another one. So it's the first couple to, you know, we had about a 4-year break between each of the previous stores, and then going into Portland. So it's been it's felt a little bit slow, but that's just us getting used to doing it. And we're kind of at that point now that we're starting to feel better about our ability to do them more quickly. So I think we're going to try to get Portland open and try to get started on another one right away. More to come soon, but really trying to focus on Portland right now.
Have you put any serious consideration into other regions or like non-West Coast?
We have talked about that. There's so many good places to put a store. We have a whole list. We've actually created a hopefully I'm not giving too much information here, but I do have a list of 50 cities. We've put them all in and we've looked at like what we feel the population is, the interest in Magic. We can look at our online orders and see how many people are actually playing Magic there from our perspective. We can look at events that are taking place in those places, whether they're, you know, events through WotC or CFB events or Star City Games or whatever it is, just to kind of get a feel for that. And we have done that and ranked and looked at populations and prices of property and all of that. So we've been pretty serious about really looking at where in the country we could do this. And we've looked all across the US. So we have started, you know, of course, close, and Portland feels easy because it's a 3-hour drive and you can go down and do that. But I think we'll start branching out further coming in the next, you know, year or two.
Cool. Well, you guys heard it here first. There will be more Card Kingdom stores coming at some point in the future. At least that's the plan. So that's cool. Now, regarding Portland, is Portland going to, I'm assuming all of the CardKingdom.com stuff is going to remain centralized in the one store in Seattle, or are you going to start branching off operations?
No, but we'll still have the regular online operations. We'll still be in Washington. And then we will do something similar to our Bellevue store, where we'll have a portion of inventory there, but it'll be, you know, a very small piece of the inventory. But it should get you pretty much anything you need to build any modern or standard deck, should be easily done, or Pioneer. And hopefully Commander as well. So we'll have a pretty good selection of cards. We won't go super deep and have, you know, really large quantities, but we try to have enough to keep them in stock. So we will be doing that in this store in a similar way we did to Bellevue.
And in that line, I'm thinking and going down that path, are you sort of creating a standardized in-store experience, or are you looking at creating each store to be its own unique thing?
We're trying to make them consistent. However, we do, as we found things that we think could be better, we're tweaking them slightly. So I think we'll probably still play around with them for at least the first 5-6 stores, and then hopefully we find our model and we make it more consistent. But I would rather have something unique in each store. I don't really have an interest in having, you know, the cookie cutter chain experience. I like these stores to be special, and I like these stores to be unique. So I expect to continue doing that, you know, whether it be the private rooms or the themes or, you know, all of that. So I like to have a consistent experience, but a different environment, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. And again, I don't know if you can talk about this or not. Are these going to be like large operations, or are these going to be sort of small LGS type of experiences?
But they should be similar to our Ballard and Bellevue stores. I think we really like stores that are, you know, around 9,000-10,000 square feet, with restaurant space and with tournament room space and with, you know, a nice retail store as well. So we will be continuing that model.
Cool. Okay. Next question. What would you say differentiates you from your competitors? What do you believe your primary niche to be in the gaming and Magic market?
I'd say our niche or our focus is we believe playing games is fun, and we hope that Magic is fun, and we want to provide whatever you need. So we really focus on having everything in stock and trying to buy all the cards at the same time, right? So whether you're selling or buying Magic cards, we want to be able to take care of you. We don't tend to lean heavily into the super competitive Magic scene, but we do like to lean into supplying things for people who really enjoy being competitive with Magic R. So, if, for example, in our spaces, like, you can be the greatest Magic player in the world, but maybe you just want a casual game at a table with your friend, and that's more what we try to supply from an experience. But really, our niche is we want to have everything available that you could possibly need and try to have it priced at a price that's as good as anybody else. So it's difficult to balance those, and we've really focused on the inventory, but we're constantly working on price too, trying to keep us as competitive. We want to pay the most, we want to sell for the least, and that's the thing we're constantly working towards.
On the first part of that question, what would you say differentiates you from your competitors? Is that kind of in the same vein?
Yeah, like I'd say, you know, we've always done a lot with, for example, Commander, but we haven't always done the big tournament scene, right? So I'd say we are equally interested in the kitchen table players as the competitive Magic player. And I think that's different. And you'll see that from our store environments versus another store's tournament audience.
I've also noticed that you guys seem to be doing a lot more with kind of media, social media marketing, sort of PR kind of focused things, and then the products, right? Like you guys do the battle decks, and you sort of have created your own. You know, I've noticed a couple of things that definitely have the stamp of Card Kingdom on them. You know, especially particularly I've noticed more recently over the past 12 months. You've had an increased social media push and doing content and things like that.
Yeah, the social media is really really because we've put somebody squarely on it. And in the past, we've always like, well, when you have extra time, you know, we'll do social media. And we want to try to get information to people and like, hey, here's the new cards, here's the new events, here's, you know, what's going on at Card Kingdom, and trying to be more open to people and just, you know, sharing what we do and what we care about. What was the first part of what you said, Tarkin? I'm sorry.
I said I noticed that as a differentiator, and then I also know, you know, then you've also got your products like the battle decks. I mean,
things
like tokens, but you guys have actually made playable products that are your own.
Yeah, that's been super fun, and it's gone through a few different iterations, and basically started with something that was, you know, the Safari League decks they were called, and we had our current manager was an employee in the retail store at that time. And the rules were they had to either be all the same creature type or had to have a picture of that creature in the art somewhere to make a deck. And they were kind of fun and goofy, and people would, you know, come up with these really interesting ways to cobble a deck together. And basically they were fun enough that we evolved that into, hey, we've got tons and tons of cards that don't really have a lot of, let's just say there's no demand for a lot of the cards. But with a couple tweaks and getting the right cards together and maybe buying a couple cards through the buy page, we could actually put something together that was enjoyable. So we could turn this stuff that piled up into something people really valued. And it's actually a fantastic way to play. Like I love picking up a couple decks if I'm playing with somebody who is a lapsed player or, you know, isn't a super competitive player. And you just buy three or four decks for $10 a piece and just sit down and play. And they're super fun and they're well balanced. And you just, it's a good way to try the new keywords and the new archetypes from new sets. And we do a lot with the new battle decks that follow that. Like, for example, we have a new food deck based on the mechanic and throne. So it gives you a way to just kind of dive in and casually try that style of deck and play with somebody. So it's really good for acquisition or just getting people into the game or helping people to understand how different deck types work. But also just if you want to sit down with a friend and play and not invest a lot of money, it's just a really easy way to equalize that. So if you have somebody who only has $1,000 decks and you pop into play, it's not always the best experience. So it's a good way to level the playing field.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting too. It's a player-focused way to also, I mean, it allows you to create a kind of a new revenue stream, and it allows you to, you know, maybe monetize some stuff that was sitting around, but to do so in a meaningful way that's player focused.
Yeah, it's if you value experience more than $10, then it's a great product for you. You could probably do it yourself for less money, but hey, if you just want somebody to take care of that for you, it's a fantastic product for that. And I think there's a lot of people that really really desire that, and really they don't want to. There are the deck builders, and they're you know, it's a fantastic way to play Magic, and it's probably my favorite way. But if you're also, you know, just want to play without all the extra work of that, it's a perfect product.
Awesome. Next question. What kind of quality control do you have in place, if any, to ensure card grading is consistent across people and departments internally?
Oh, boy, this is this is something that I don't want to say we struggle with before, but we always really focus. And whenever you get a some feedback of somebody like, hey, I don't think the grading's consistent or something's changed. You know, we've taken that very seriously. And starting about 4 or 5 years ago, we really established a pretty rigorous program around this where, you know, as soon as you start, you basically spend a month grading cards before, and they're all double checked and somebody's sitting beside you the whole time before you get to do anything on your own. And then even after that, there's check-ins regularly and calibration exercises, and all the graders will get together and they'll pass cards around and everybody says what their grade is in their head, and then everybody says it together. And if anybody's different, you go back and review. So we do a lot of work around just making sure everybody treats cards the same way. Any high value cards, you know, if there's something that's, you know, $100 and up, dual land and up, that kind of stuff, if you have that kind of a card, you're always going to have a second opinion on that card just because the value on those cards is high, and we want to make sure that people are getting a fair, accurate grade of that. So anytime you have one of those cards, you will grade it, go through it, but you'll have somebody come over and sign off on an initial that they double check your grade and they agree. We do a lot of counterfeit training, you know, just making sure if you're going through and I slip a counterfeit in this pile of cards, you spot it and you pull that out. We do basically decks, right? So we will take decks of cards, and because we start with grading on the back, we will write on the front with a magic marker, and we'll write near mint and excellent and very good and good on all the cards. And it's just a great calibration tool that anybody can always grab on those deck of cards, grade the pile, turn them over, and see if they were all the same.
Interesting.
And then, you know, we do a lot of work around different things, like foils are, you know, different than regular cards. And are you well-versed in that, and making sure that we continue to work on that and make sure things are working. And, you know, we'll buy cards occasionally from other places to make sure that the standards they have and ours are consistent, and just, you know, talk about that and making sure that within the industry that we feel like we're positioned in the right spot. So actually a lot, we do a lot around that. And we believe that is, you know, probably the most sensitive thing you can have, right? Selling your cards, people are much more sensitive to the grading of cards you're purchasing than the ones they're buying even. And so we want to make sure that we're being very, very careful with that and that people trust us. That's probably our core thing, is we want to make sure that when you send cards to us, you completely trust that we're taking care of you and doing things consistently and fair, and that you believe what we're telling you. And so we'll put a lot of time into that. We don't have to, I suppose, but long term, I think it's better for us as a company and better for our relationships with our customers, and that's how we grow. If you know that if you send to us, you're going to be treated the same every time, then you understand that that's the way we are. And if you have a problem with it, you should reach out and talk with us, and we are here to listen.
So I have a sort of a rebel radical idea I'm curious to get your thoughts on. I always thought, what if there was a world where, and I don't mean a world, but would it be possible for, because grading, as you just said, it's one of the touchiest things that creates, there's a lot of emotions that go into that, and people sometimes they're thrilled, or then they get frustrated. Is there a way where the industry could evolve to where the middle of the grading tiers is removed and you literally have near mint and played until you get into sort of like vintage and the graded, and then you have a more of a scale? But do you ever foresee, or do you think it's possible to model it to where you just have cards that are near mint and then you have cards that are played? And that way you don't have this, as it feels like it creates layers of complexity by having these sort of, because it's whether it's EX or VG, or, you know, or it's lightly played and moderately played, right? Like these sort of middle ground areas is where I think a lot of people struggle with. What do you think about that?
It's you know, it's hard to balance because you got to look at how different people are approaching the cards. And for example, if you put together, you know, EX and near mint feel more similar to me than like VG and G, right? Like the heavily played, moderately played feel more the same than the lightly played versus the mint cards, if you know what I mean. I don't know if you feel that way or not, but just on overall viewing of the card. And so depending on where you split, like if you went near mint to that, most players don't care a whole lot if a card's lightly played or near mint, especially in a sleeve. And you will see like a card that's in lesser condition tends to sell faster than a card near mint condition, and just the throughput's faster. But then you have those customers like that are building sets that really, really care, right? You'll send them a card, and if it's just got the slightest little mark on it, that most of us would still be like, yeah, that's near mint. Of course that's near mint. And they're just really frustrated by it. Like trying to keep those lines for those customers is important as well. So it's, you know, we've toyed around with it, and maybe this is a radical idea, but there's something my brother John has talked about a lot. Like, what if we had a pool of cards that, like, you just send them in and you get paid this price no matter what the grade is, and you can buy from that pool no matter what the grade is? Yeah, just let that fly and see what happens. So we've talked about that. And then you get into these things where we're like, well, what do you do with, you know, those cards that have a radically different value from a mint card to a played card? And are you opening yourself up to just buy and sell a card over and over and lose money on it? So it takes a lot of thought in how you implement it to make sure that we're protecting, you know, ourselves from losing money on that. Because as soon as we do that, we have to stop. So, yeah, it's an interesting concept. And it's a, I think, if you can get cards for a lower price because they're played, and we can find a way to make that smoother for not only people selling, but the people buying, that would be a great solution. So we have talked about it, but we haven't figured it out yet.
Yeah. And you know, obviously it's tough because the standards have been set for however many, 25, 30, well, I mean, since baseball cards, but I guess, you know, like you just to your point, most people are like near mint LP is relatively the same. Where they have issues is because the value is different. Well, yeah. Obviously this group's like, okay, well, there's a price difference between a near mint and lightly played. Even if when they are holding the card, they look at it like, it's not that much of a difference. Right.
Right.
So when you start going down that, like you said, when you start going down that road of thought, it's like, okay, well, what if near mint and EX/LP were just one near mint grade? It's near mint. And then everything else under that. Right. And it's really complicated, but I was just kind of curious to see what you thought about that. And it's interesting to hear that you guys have sort of considered the same thing, that maybe there is a model that would work in.
Yeah, we've definitely talked about it, and it's maybe it just depends on the card too, right? Like certain cards people don't care and other cards people do. And for example, there's no way you'd want to apply that to like alpha beta unlimited cards.
Right. Right.
Just exactly. Because and that's what happens, right? One person's like, well, what if we just did this? And somebody else is like, yeah, but it totally breaks on alpha cards. And then you start talking about two different things. So a part of that is just having those open discussions and actually seriously approaching it and trying to find a model where it works.
Awesome. Okay. Well, let's carry on here. I want to make sure we have enough time to try and hit all these questions. What is the largest buy list order you ever processed, and how long did it take?
Boy, for me personally, I don't know what it'd be in 10 years.
Have you heard internally of someone being like, oh my gosh, we just got in a $500,000. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but you know, like,
well, let me give you a couple numbers. I actually threw out a question earlier today on this, cause I thought this question was going to come up. Let's see. So in the last year, I have one person who says, I think it was I did. So here's something from a grader who did a 15,000 card order about a year ago. Wow. So that would have been an actual purchase order of 15,000 cards, which is big. It doesn't come close to touching some of the bulk orders. So if you want to hear something really crazy.
Yes.
We had a bulk order in this summer that was 371,000 cards.
Wow. Did they happen to mention, was that like all bulk rares or was it just...
Yeah. There's like bulk rares. It might have been bulk rare, bulk land, but usually when they get really big like that, they're predominantly bulk. Which usually when that happens, we have to lower our price on bulk rares a little bit. So sorry about that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I noticed that you guys went from, well, you obviously went from 10 to 8, which was a big shift. But then recently, or I think it was recently, you went from 8 to 7.
Yeah, and that's just the, I don't know if how much that is just the nature of the number of cards coming out, the number of circulation, but it just gets to that point where when you have a pallet of rares just waiting to be sorted, that you got to slow them down somehow. And that's the easiest way to do it.
It's interesting. We had John Sasso of Channel Fireball on, and his perspective was, he said for like the past 15 years, he has been trying to get bulk rares to just be a flat 5 cents. He said he always thought they should be 5 cents, and he just thinks they should be 5 cents.
Yeah, before we started buying in bulk, we did pay five was our floor, but it was all individual, right? And, you know, everybody else was buying bulk rares, and somebody convinced us that we should be buying bulk rares, and everybody else was paying 10, so we did. But yeah, if you go back a few years ago, we were paying five as our floor for rares, and it might be the right price. He very likely is right.
Yeah. Okay, carrying on. What effects has the Pioneer? So we talked a little bit of Pioneer. The question is, what has it had on the sales from other formats? Or I guess, did you notice any ripple effect when Pioneer was announced on other formats sales?
No, not specifically. There was definitely, it felt more like a lift in sales when Pioneer was announced. It's seeming to settle out. Like there was definitely a bump when it was first announced that went for, I'd say, a week or so. And then it's, you know, looks like we might still be up a little bit from it as people are doing that. But I didn't see here. I'm actually going to pull up one of my fancy little graphs over here and look at that and see if I see anything crazy happening in other formats. Give me just a moment. And if I look at other formats, I'd say, no, not really. Looks like everything's still continuing on. And I have not built out my tool yet to account for Pioneer yet. So this is updated on November 4th. I'm going to do one other thing. But yeah, it looks like things have been fairly stable. I mean, there's just the variability. Although I will tell you, I see a little spike in standard happening right now. So we'll see. We'll see what that is.
Good. That's encouraging.
I think if you look at the price of Oko, I've noticed it being a lot. So somebody feels like that card's going to get banned and they're going to open up. So maybe people are already starting to build decks. We'll see.
Interesting. Okay. Next question. Has your relationship with QS, did that result in some more business your way via buy list and whatnot and purchasing?
Yeah, I think that our work with you has always been good for us. People definitely come through. You know, we've worked on that CSV tool a while ago, which we haven't done a lot of marketing or improvements on, and we should revisit that at some point in time. I think that's been great. I think anytime we can, you know, work with somebody to make it easier to look at the data, decide if it makes sense for them to sell cards to us is good. I feel very comfortable with what we pay for cards. So having them on a site like Quiet Speculation, I think, is a benefit for us just because, you know, anytime we can get eyes on that, I believe is good. So yeah, I've always been really happy with our relationship and our sharing of information with you. So I'm very positive about that.
All right, moving on. David Schumann here asks, is there any truth to the rumors of automation in your sorting process?
we've toyed around with it. We haven't done a whole, but it's definitely something we considered. It's our truth and rumors. We have interest. I have a brother who likes playing around with things like that. So, you know, he'll toy around with it. But we really haven't done a whole lot, at least at this point in time. But it's definitely something we'd consider.
All right. Do you think booster boxes are still a good long-term investment with the massive print runs we have these days? Contemporary.
Yeah, I think they still are. And you will see it, you know, ebb and flow. And every once in a while you'll see that where there's a lot more printed than you thought would be printed. And maybe I have better data on that than the general public. But you can see when you see a price on a somewhat limited product suddenly bottom out, that's a good indication that, hey, the market just got flooded with a bunch of them. And if you see something where just nobody has them and the price is creeping up, that's the opposite. And that's long term, that's going to be a good thing. But really, the biggest long term effect on that is going to be the desirability of the cards. So even a set where it seems like it was super overprinted, but the card value is good and the product value is good, you will see that going up. And, you know, I haven't really looked at, like, for example, sealed commander sets, right? This is different than booster boxes, but just because I'm very familiar with how the Commander 2016 went. When 2016 came out, we basically sold out of that at the point of release, everything was gone. We'd sold all of our decks, we'd cracked a bunch and sold all the singles, and it was just gone. And I haven't looked recently at what the price is on Commander 2016 decks, but I'm sure they're up a long ways from where they were. Sets after that, they printed a little bit more, but there's interesting good cards and people open them up. And as soon as people open them up and the cards are in circulation, if you want that sealed product, it does go up in price. Even the boxes that tend to be not super desirable over time tend to be good. I don't know, Return to Ravnica being the first set in the Pioneer block, you know, that was one of those boxes that felt like it was just printed, you know, overprinted. There was a ton of it. And, you know, without looking, because I haven't actually looked, that might be, I would imagine that's probably a box that's going to go up faster than you would have expected. Khans of Tarkir, I think everybody looked at that and like, hey, that's got the lands. That's going to be a good box going forward, even though if you buy a lot of bulk rares like I do, you realize, man, there must have been a lot of Khans of Tarkir open, because there's always just tons and tons of Khans rares. Those boxes, I think, are doing really well. So if you look at the cards in the set and you look at the printing, you can probably do a little better. But really, I think the cards are the driving on that. And when they dry up and they go up. I remember Fifth Dawn being a box that I remember buying a few and thinking, well, they bought them out at like $50 a booster box. So why not? I'll buy a few. And I put six in my closet. And then, I don't know, a year or two, I decided, oh, I have these boxes in my closet. I might as well sell them. And I was shocked at how much a Fifth Dawn booster box went for.
Much different than when you were getting them for $50.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And every once in a while, it doesn't happen as much anymore. I don't think I'm willing to let those go at a loss. And there are people that will snatch them up before they get that low. But if you go back and look at the boxes that were not popular when they came out, you know, Scourge was that way, or Fifth Dawn was that way. And you have these boxes that dropped to, yeah, like you could buy boxes for 50. Unglued was that. Unhinged did that. Unstable never did. But, you know, Unhinged dropped to the point where you could pick up boxes all day long for $40 to $50. Now you look at them and you think, wow, wish I would have held on to some of that. Cold Snap was that way. Cold Snap was, you couldn't give this stuff away. And now, you know, with those snow-covered lands, it's a good, good box. So if you have a long-term patience, the history has shown that it's good, and it continues to be so. I don't know if there's many boxes you can look at that are more than 5-6 years old or older. You're going to be doing okay on pretty much all of them.
All right. So you heard it from Damon. Not the worst thing in the world to be going in on boosters. But you did make the caveat that you think the cards are all, you think the cards are probably better to look at than the boxes, right?
Yeah, like if you had to I think
Damon, would you rather be buying cards for a return or boxes? How would you respond to that?
Oh, long term, I'd probably buy boxes. Okay. Personally.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say the cards in the box are a really good indicator of the value of the, you know, for example, Zendikar is a really expensive box. It's not just because they had, you know, a lot of desirability at release, but those cards ended up being fantastic long term, and that box has really, really outperformed other editions. But other editions have done well as well.
All right. Next question from Matt Cardbreaker. Are the current non-foil to foil spreads on the old frame foils very realistic? For example, is there that really that much demand for the foil 7th edition card? So looking at the old frame, I think that was pre-8th edition or 10th edition or something. I think it was in the old frame. The spreads between the foil and non-foil are just, the gaps are huge. Do you think that's a realistic? Those numbers are realistic, and particularly he's asking about 7th edition foils.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a long, long time since I cracked anything 7th edition data on contributions and all that. But yeah, 7th edition foils are hard, and they're hard to get, and they're hard to get in good condition, and they sell very quickly. So that price difference is real. And you have the same sort of thing with like Urza's Destiny, right? Those foils, just there aren't very many of them. I think it's Destiny, not Legacy. I might be getting those two mixed up. But yeah, I'd say that scarcity is real on those sets, on those few at least. Yeah, I'd say 7th edition and the Urza's set, those were definitely, there just aren't very many of them.
Okay, great. Next question. We talked about this. What are your thoughts about the future of Legacy? I think you mentioned that, you know, you hope people keep supporting it to keep it alive. Do you think that Modern replaces Legacy? We sort of talked about that. I think you said that you would maybe agree that Modern sometimes feels like Legacy light for kind of those players.
Yeah, but I'd say I think Legacy is a whole different thing, and it has a different player base. It has a different nostalgia. I don't see it going away completely ever. Although the support might ebb and flow just based on what stores and tournament organizers are doing. But you know, I'm committed to trying to keep it going in our stores, and I think it's a niche that might not be as big as Modern, but it's worth supporting, and I think it's important, and I think people want to play it. So I'm supportive of it, and I think we will continue doing it in our locations.
Great. You mentioned, this question was, what are your thoughts about so much product from Wizards? And you mentioned right now you'd like to see them kind of tone it down a little bit if you had your choice.
Yeah. I go back and forth on this. If I look at actually pieces of, you know, like War of the Spark and Modern Horizons again, like I wish I could have bought more of it. Like the actual distribution to us, we were asking for more than they would give us. So that was a, you know, at the release time, that was a factor, like how much we were able to buy. Then Throne came and, you know, we didn't get everything we asked for, but at the same time, we didn't sell through that. So, you know, we will, but it wasn't it didn't meet our expectations of sales. So the amount of product being produced is really hard to understand, and how that distribution and how those allocations. And it's a black box to me. Like, I don't really know how much is out there and what other people are getting. But, you know, Commander, the same thing. Like, at release, we were running out of Commander, and we were just, you know, super anxious to get that next printing so we could have enough to, you know, sell the decks to people in our stores. So it's, I think the allocations, they're doing a pretty good job of not just flooding the market with things. I don't feel like it's this, you know, overprinting. But there's just so many products right now that I do worry there's a bit of customer sort of getting a little bit saturated with how many products and keeping up with what's going on. So as long as you can keep them varied and not too many cards in every release, I think it's okay. But I think we're kind of maxing out. Maybe the hobby needs to grow into that to sustain that level of printing.
All right, moving on here. What was the most difficult problem to solve when it came to scaling the size of your inventory?
I'm sorry, can you say that one more time?
What was the most difficult or challenging problem to solve when it came to scaling the size of your inventory?
Oh, this is just the, you know, when you have, for example, a new format or a new thing happening or growing quickly, it's balancing that, how much is in stock and keeping the right things in stock. And you would have these periods where you would fall behind, and there's this cascading effect, right? Like, we're growing, so we need to buy more cards, and we buy price cards are coming in, and then we have to actually process more cards, and then we have to train new graders to do that and make sure that their consistency is good and the product is good and that, you know, the customer selling to us is getting a good service. And then, but then if we're not getting through the cards, we're not putting the cards in stock and not meeting sales. So it's this feedback mechanism. Like, if you're hitting on all cylinders and everything's perfect, you grow gracefully into a higher inventory, but it's bumpy, right? And you balancing that's tough. And if you don't have the cards in stock, you're not selling the cards, which is depressing your ability to make those sales and your ability to buy. So it's just that balance. It's that balance of keeping the cards coming and going at the same speed and trying to maintain your inventories. And if you run out of a card, you're paying, we pay a higher percentage. And anybody who's done selling to us, probably, you know, a lot of selling to us, understands that we'll pay a really good price on a card if we don't have it and we don't have enough coming in. And so that's bad for our profit margin, right? If we're paying 70% on a card, once it gets through all the operations and all the handling and all of that, we're not doing well on that card, especially if we're paying store credit on a lot of that. So it's really trying to keep that in balance and trying to hold your inventory in a place that you're not only buying it at a good level, but selling at a good level, and you have an offering to your customer. Kind of what I started this off with. We want to be purchasing every card, and we want to be selling every card. And if we can find that balance, that's good. But anytime you're growing quickly, that becomes more difficult.
Awesome. Will the new Portland location that's opening soon accept sell orders in-house if I set up the order online? Does that make sense? So if they set up an online, can they sell it in-house?
You know, I haven't actually had that discussion yet, but I believe so. We do that in Bellevue, which is obviously much closer, things back and forth. But I'm going to say yes, and then I have to now make sure that happens.
Okay, sweet. A couple of questions here about some numbers in your operations, which we'll really glaze over those. Don't want to get into too many details here. And then we've got another one here about data. Hold on a second here. Besides looking at past data, will you also look at trying to predict future behavior for card prices? For example, IBM has analysis of tweets set up that can predict fashion interest and recommend a customer to increase production of a certain dress, for example. Mm-hmm.
We really don't. Like, I feel we have the wherewithal to catch those things. You know, for example, hey, this card's getting banned. It's in this deck. Therefore, this deck is no longer going to be competitive. So the other piece in that deck is not going to be as popular. So that price should go down. We tend not to do that. And I believe we do that because we think the hobby is very reactive to that. And so we will follow that trend because it's complicated. And perhaps there'll be another card that will replace the original banned card and that deck will stay viable and it will continue to go. I think trying to predict that outside of the market is problematic because you use your gut and you use your you can overstate what effect you think is going to be, but that doesn't change the fact that we will watch that very carefully using what we know. So we believe this card is going to go down, so we will keep a real close eye on that card to make sure that we're reacting, or we believe this card is going to spike, so we're watching that card to make sure that we follow the market on it. But we tend not to be super proactive on making those changes without supporting data. That will change, of course. Like, there's a banning. You know, that $10 card, we will price down to $4.99 immediately just because that is what we know is going to happen. And generally, when you do that, they're coming in so fast anyway that you don't have to do that without looking at that data. But yeah, we tend not to try to predict the future. We tend to rely more on data.
Cool. Would you consider, or are you considering expanding your operations to other parts of the world outside of the U.S.?
It's an interesting concept, and maybe someday, but I have no plans to do so. Although I think that would be super fascinating and fun and interesting. I'm not quite up to speed on international business and the rules around transferring inventory across country lines and all of that. So it would take some investigation, but I think it'd be a kick. It'd be fun and be a great business venture, but I have no current plans.
Well, I'm kind of curious along those lines really quick. Do you notice, like, there's, cause you obviously do international business. Do you notice, oh wow, like there's the market for this format or these cards is very different in this part of the world because we sell so much more of that here. And conversely, we get so much more of this stuff from this part of the world. Like, there's, do you see sort of, disparities in different markets internationally?
I don't see a whole lot of that. I will see sometimes, for example, in Japan, you'll see the new standard cards during pre-release. They will go a little deeper on speculating on the cards, and they do a good job of it too. Like, they're very good at, I still remember a discussion at the shop about Torrential Gear Hulk, and people who were very seasoned Magic players saying, yeah, it's just too expensive, that card's not going to be good. And then a lot of Japanese customers were obviously voting with their dollars to say that they were wrong, and they were absolutely right. So I'll occasionally see something like that, but the international sales are not, the predominant amount of our sales, and they do exist, but they tend to be fairly consistent, and they tend to be, very highly variable too. Like, you will see people that are buying cards that are probably for resale, that they're obviously selling a lot of casual cards, or they might be selling commander cards, but I wouldn't say that specific countries I've noticed a specific trend by format.
Okay. Interesting. Do you ever have to blacklist notorious buylisters who just simply don't send in their orders?
We talk about this a lot, and it's problematic because if people place orders and don't send them, it's bad because we count on those cards coming in, and then we don't have them and our customers can't buy them. So it kind of clogs up the thing for everybody. So I don't know how often we've actually banned somebody, but we have sent emails or discussions or asked to please, treat it differently. And if we have somebody who in the past has often not sent orders in, we will, cancel them more aggressively as time has gone on, or request, feedback on whether we can cancel them. So we try not to, but every once in a while we will be more proactive about getting those orders out of our system just to open it up for people to continue selling us that card.
Okay. Since you only run local stores and warehouses at this point currently, how could someone try to build relationships with you as a large vendor? Any recommendation for individuals that can't go to large events is trying to build, expand their network with vendors? Any kind of recommendation for how they can sort of, start doing business with Card Kingdom and maybe build a relationship with you guys?
I mean, the best thing is probably just to send cards and use our service. And if you like doing it, it's great. We don't really give special deals to people. We try to keep a level playing field for everybody. And we try to, hope everybody will treat us the way that we treat them, and we have a positive relationship with everybody. But do know, like, if you are sending us cards and you want feedback or you want to talk with us, send us a note. Let us know how it's going. And people do talk about it, and people do talk about, the customers that they love and the neat notes. And, it's actually pretty endearing to go in and you can sit at a grader's desk and look at the little notes they've put up. We have certain customers that have been with us for years that send notes to us. And, you might think, oh, that's just going to get put in the garbage. But, the graders will cut those out and paste them up all around their desk. And, they really love that. They love the feedback, and they'll get shared. Like, I'll see things on our chat channel all the time about, hey, this customer said this and had this really great experience and, great job. And we do appreciate that. And even if there's customers that are in other countries or other parts of the country that we've never met in person, we have those discussions all the time. And I hear people's names pop up all the time. And that'll come, kind of like what you're talking about with people who don't send cards in. You'll hear the, person X placed another order and, hasn't sent them in, even though they've had three orders since then have been placed and received. And, can I cancel that? Because it's getting in the way of this and that and the other thing. But equally, and probably more so, there's those discussions of, hey, this customer sent in this really nice note, and, or snack cakes, or this cool piece of art, or they drew this picture, or they have this really, awesome story. And we do discuss that stuff a lot. We feel we have great relationships with our customers, and the people who are interfacing with the people selling cards. I mean, we really do care, and we really do have what I think is great relationships, even if half the time it's only in, you know, little notes and packages.
Awesome. That's encouraging to hear. I'm actually, along those lines, I have a kind of an operational question that I'm curious about, simply because magic is becoming so much more. I mean, we're far removed from the days where it was just like, you know, trading and this and that, and things are becoming more sophisticated. So how do you feel about, like, you have, obviously you have tiers, right? You have players and people that just send you cards, but then you have like enterprise sort of customers and or, you know, sellers that send stuff to you and they're doing large volume. Have you ever considered sort of like a tiered program where it's kind of like a point system or some kind of tier where it's like, okay, we have a program for enterprise users who, you know, working with other vendors is part of their business. And so we sort of have this kind of enterprise B2B system or program set, you know, available. Have you guys ever talked about doing something like that or, you know, implementing a kind of B2B program?
We've talked about it and, you know, we've done some one-off, you know, programs with people where, hey, well, let's up the quantities you can send in or play around with that. And we really haven't done a whole lot with that. That's been very limited and kind of in testing. But you know, the idea is always kicking around. Like what can we do to encourage people to do this and that? But you know, buying cards is a big part of what we do, and buying more cards is a benefit. You just have to make sure we're buying the cards in the right proportion. So setting those things up to up quantities, we end up buying a lot of cards that we end up not selling, or they're cards that are going down in price, and those are the most available cards. So it's a difficult balance to not just lose money on particular cards to do that. So something we're very interested in, something, you know, like I talked about at the very beginning of the podcast, trying to find ways to remove barriers to sell us cards. And that is one of the big things, is people who have a lot of cards or have a lot of capacity to send us cards. How do we ease that transition? And whether that's through special services or if that's through just a better mechanism.
Well, then conversely, I'm curious, have you ever considered adjusting the quantity limits that people can buy?
Yes, actually, I was writing up some programs on that just, I would say, 3 days ago. I was on an airplane writing down, hey, what if we did this on cards above this threshold and this? So yeah, that's something that I've just started kicking around the last couple of weeks, and I put on the docket for, you know, consideration for our, you know, this new inventory program we're working through. So I could see that happening soon. How much interest do you think there is in that? Do you think that's a big thing?
I would say within communities like this, absolutely. I can tell you that, well, I can only speak from my own, you know, personal experience and anecdotally, but for example, Channel Fireball, you are allowed to buy, like if they list fifth, whatever the number that's listed is the number you can buy. So if it says 50, you can buy 50. If it says 20, you can buy 20. Now the trend typically is I think it's like 50 and 20. I've noticed where the, but they have very high limits. And then you can go, when you make an order, you can go back and reorder again. Now that's a totally different methodology. And I have no idea if that's something that would work with you guys, but the way they have it set up is as long as it's available, you can buy it essentially. You might have to make multiple orders. Yeah, I can tell you with almost near certainty that this group, for example, would love to be able to buy past 8 copies of a rare and 20 copies of a common.
Yeah, I assume so. And it makes sense. I mean, we also buy those cards, you know, occasionally where we feel like we need more of a card and, or we're building a battle deck and we need some, you know, extras of this, you know, bulk rare. We'll go out there and buy a large quantity. And I can see how that'd be frustrating if you're trying to do something like that with Card Kingdom and buying them 8 at a time. So as long as we can protect our inventory from, you know, fluctuations and make sure that our customers are getting that card, that's really the only barrier to that. And I think we can do that with, as long as we have a certain number of a card or a certain amount over sales of that card in a given week, we should be able to raise that limit. So I'll be looking into that over the next month.
Yeah, I mean, even as you mentioned, like even if you had some sort of automated modulation system where it was like, okay, we have 500 of this card, we can make the available quantity 40. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And so, yeah, that's to me, that's the first thing that comes to mind. I don't know how realistic that is, but it seems like a sort of, some sort of automated modulation system that would just, you know, have thresholds and that would set the quantity. That, yeah, that'd be awesome, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And we could do something like that. I mean, where we've fallen down in the past is you have somebody who, you know, opens six carts, puts 50 in every cart, and then checks out at the same time in every cart. Right. And, you know, manipulations like that, that we have to protect ourselves from. But, as long as we could set that up and, you know, make it clear that, hey, you can place one order for the max quantity a day and we're going to set that at 50. I think that's a win-win because we give you more information and you are able to make those purchases without, you know, somebody emailing you later and saying, hey, well, our max quantity is this, so please place extra orders tomorrow. I think that's good for everybody.
Awesome. Well, Damon, I am running a little short on time now. I've got to wrap it up. I know you are very busy. I'm sure you have things to do as well. Man, I can't thank you enough for coming on. It's just always a blast when you're able to come on, hang out, and chat with us.
Yeah, thanks for reaching out. It's always good to talk with you.
Yeah, and I look forward to doing more of these in the future. And if anybody wants to kind of ping, you know, shoot you a message or any feedback or anything, what's the best way they can do that?
I'm a terrible person at things like that with social media, but here, let me look up real quick my Twitter handle, and then if anybody wants to, they can shoot something at me there. I think it's just Damon_@CK, but let me look. That's how often I'm on there, but I'm sure it'll notify me. Yeah, it's just @Damon_CK.
Awesome. And then if they just want to give general feedback, have their voices heard as far as processes and whatnot, for, you know, the Card Kingdom, you know, retail operation or online, what's the best way for them to do that?
Usually, like on our website, we have a customer support email. Feel free to reach out to them. There's an FAQ, you know, fresh desk base that kind of goes through how to contact us, ask us questions. Feel free to go through there. They tend to get distributed through the organization to the right person. So just, you know, our general customer support is probably the best if you're wanting to know anything about our online or retail stores.
Awesome. Well, Damon, thanks again so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm sure the listeners did as well. All right, guys. Thank you so much, everyone. This has been the QS VendorCast with Damon Morris, co-owner of Card Kingdom. I'm Tarkan Dospel. It was a blast to be back. I will be back again soon with some other ones. And yeah, thank you so much, Damon.
Yeah, thank you. Have a great day.
All right. See ya.
All right. Bye.